refugee in Bismarck, North Dakota, makes a plea to her neighbors.
Open your doors to us because we have seen a lot. We have been through a lot. And we only come to North Dakota because we want to survive.
The Trump administration is giving city and state governments the option to say no to refugee resettlement. Some Americans want to do just that.
If we have the ability to help people that are here in our community, we should help them first.
I'm Marco Werman. We also hear from a critic of Vladimir Putin about a crackdown on opponents of the Russian president. And we return to a shrinking glacier near the South Pole.
Truth be told, weather is, I think, the biggest concern. It's been a rough year for weather in Antarctica.
Those stories and more today here on The World. Without a doubt, one of the biggest news stories of this year has been the global exodus of migrants and refugees. It's something you might have heard this week from Pope Francis in his annual Christmas speech in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday. It is injustice that makes them cross deserts and seas that become cemeteries, Francis said. It is injustice that turns them away from places where they might have hoped for a dignified life, but instead find themselves before walls of indifference. This week was the deadline ordered by President Trump for state and local governments to declare whether they will reject refugees or continue to admit and resettle them. It's widely seen as a move to split states on this issue. The World's Monica Campbell joins us for an update. Monica, the deadline had been December 25th, but then this week got extended to January 21st. Why did the Trump administration put forward this deadline for these letters of consent in the first place? What was the rationale?
The rationale was to give local officials a say in whether they wanted to be a part of this federal refugee resettlement program. Nothing like this had been asked before at the state level so directly, you know. What the consensus is that this executive order is part of the Trump administration's overall goal of limiting the number of migrants and refugees to the United States. This order came when the Trump administration also announced that it would cut the number of refugees allowed into the United States on a yearly basis to 18,000, and that's a historic low. So far, not a single state or county has said that they'll refuse accepting refugees. And more than 30 states have said that they will continue to receive refugees in their states and counties. More than 30, but still we have over a dozen states to hear from.
So what have you heard from some of the debates over whether to reject or accept refugees? Like at the local level, what does that sound like?
Well, at the local level, there have been these quiet pushes by religious leaders, by resettlement agencies. But what happened earlier this month in Bismarck, the capital of North Dakota, was really interesting. Word spread that the county commission was considering rejecting the refugee program. And this part of North Dakota last year got 24 refugees. And it turns out hundreds of people came out from both sides to voice their opinion. The first person that we'll hear from is Masa Harris. She's a refugee. She lives in Bismarck. She walked up to the podium, adjusted the mic, and spoke.
We are not coming to North Dakota to rob anybody. Hell, we have been robbed of our childhood. We have been robbed of a lot of things. We have starved. We have seen walls. We have suffered. We have been hungry. So coming to North Dakota is a privilege. And I tell you tonight, don't be selfish. Open your doors to us because we have seen a lot. We have been through a lot. And we only come to North Dakota because we want to survive.
Many refugees who live in this part of North Dakota came and spoke up. Then we also heard from people like Luke Langenfelder. Here's what he said.
We have so many homeless here that have drug problems, have all kinds of problems. Why not take that money, help those people get ahead and put them in some of these positions before we bring over a bunch of other people? And I understand it's not a lot of immigrants, but if we have the ability to help people that are here in our community, we should help them first.
That seems like a really heavily charged debate. So what ended up being the decision?
In the end, the county commission voted 3-2 in favor of continuing to resettle refugees in Bismarck, North Dakota.
So the actual deadline now is on January 21st. What are you going to be looking for until then, Monica?
Three refugee resettlement agencies have sued to block this executive order from the Trump administration. They argue that it's a violation of the Refugee Act and it's unconstitutional because the federal government should decide immigration policy. This shouldn't be decided at the state and local level. A federal judge should rule on this at some point in January. So we'll see how this goes, and we'll also be watching how states like Texas and Florida decide on this issue.
The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Immigration is a theme that's showing up more and more in children's books. In 2016, by one count, there were about a dozen books that dealt directly with questions like, what does it mean to be American? By 2018, more than 100 kids' books addressed themes like migration, navigating a new language and culture. There's even a picture book about what life is like for a child whose dad is being held at an immigrant detention center. This past year, a revered Caldecott honor went to the book, Alma and How She Got Her Name. It's about identity and connecting to one's roots. Juana Martinez-Neal is the author and illustrator. She joined us from her home in Phoenix, and I began by asking Juana to read the opening lines of that book.
Alma Sofia Esperanza Jose Pura Candela had a long name, too long if you ask her. My name is so long, Daddy, it never fits, Alma said. Come here, he said. Let me tell you the story of your name. Then you decide if it fits. And that's how the book starts.
Right. So slowly but surely, Alma has her name story revealed to her by her dad. So what is Alma's story? Who is Alma? Does she actually exist?
I would say it's semi-autobiographical. It started with the idea of my name and how I was named, and then slowly changed into the story of Alma, even though the relatives are my relatives.
The book begins with Alma pretty frustrated by the length of her name. Did you have the same kind of feeling when you were a kid?
My name was Juana Carlota Martinez Pizarro. And in Peru, you carry both your father's last name and your mother's last names. And then Juana is my name. I was named after my father's mother, my grandmother. And then Carla, I was supposed to be Carla, but it was changed to Carlota. My dad changed it at the last minute when he was, you know, writing my name in the birth certificate. But both together, they are so old fashioned, and everything was just so, so very Spanish. I did not like my name at all.
There is so much wrapped up in one's name. And I was watching this moment on the Netflix show Patriot Act, the talk show with comedian Hasan Minhaj. And he revealed this part of his story.
I remember when I first started comedy, at the first open mics, there was this host. You'd write your name down and he's like, look, man, nobody's going to be able to pronounce this. You got to change your name. And I legit thought it was like a real thing. He's like, come on, man. You think there's a guy named Jamie Foxx? He changed his name. And he did. So for like 2 months, I would go to open mics and I was Sean. I'm like, dude, what am I doing? Legit, I was like, oh, I'm Sean, right?
So, Juan, I mean, that's pretty funny. But then Minhaj then explains that he went on the Ellen show and his parents were there. And just like the shift from one generation to another, they were almost annoyed that he kept Hasan. There was like the sense that the first generation arrivals wanted a clearer belief that their offspring were truly American, even though his parents named him Hasan. So when you wrote this kid's book, were those kinds of tensions on your mind?
Not really. I mean, I think I wanted to go even more into my roots and, you know, my own story being an immigrant from Peru. It was very important to me to make it as authentic as I could, as Spanish as I could. I mean, it was so important for me to have names that not only were Spanish, but could have a translation that's, you know, like Esperanza means hope and Alma means soul. Candela means fire, or you know, it was just so important to pick the right names for each one of these characters.
And let's remember that Alma and How She Got Her Name is a children's book. How important are these themes of immigration and identity for children to learn about?
To me, it's the most important part of, you know, if you know who you are, you can share it, but you understand it by knowing who came after you, how you carried all these, I don't know, the culture, the traditions, that who you are, your language, even your accent. Once you understand who you are, you can share that with the world. So identity is so important to me.
There are now dozens of books about immigration and what it means to be a new American. What do you think is inspiring this wave of books?
Maybe it's just that we are getting more of a place where we get a chance to be published. And that's a wonderful thing, because being American means so many different things, right? And we're just telling one other story of how it is or what it means to be an American.
Juana Martinez-Neal, author of Alma and How She Got Her Name. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
A diplomatic spat that's erupted between Mexico and Bolivia is not going away. The two nations are some 3,000 miles apart geographically, but tensions are simmering over Mexico's treatment of the ousted president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. A popular protest drove the leftist leader out of office last month, and Morales was granted asylum in Mexico. The new conservative government in Bolivia is now going after his supporters. Nine of them have found refuge inside the Mexican embassy building in Bolivia's capital, La Paz. Today, Mexico's leftist president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said the right of asylum must be guaranteed. Mexico has accused Bolivia of harassing its embassy staff and violating international law. Here's Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard.
Que se preserve y se respete.
The integrity of our facilities and the people within the facilities are considered part of the Mexican territory. They need to be preserved and respected.
Ebrard went on to say that Mexico will be making a formal diplomatic complaint in The Hague and elsewhere.
We are going to file the appeal with the International Court of Justice. The United Nations and other international organizations were contacted. For what? Well, to ensure that the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which governs the behavior and obligations of each country with regard to the diplomatic offices in each country, is respected.
For the last month, about 100 members of Bolivia's security forces have been surrounding the Mexican embassy in La Paz. Mexico says those Bolivian forces stopped and attempted to search the limousine of its ambassador while she was in it. Mexico also says the Bolivians are using drones to keep its embassy compound under surveillance. Mexican Minister Ebrard says his country will not be intimidated.
We have 10,000 Mexican men and women in Bolivia that we have to attend to. And at the embassy, we have 9 people who applied for asylum under international law. We are not going to withdraw our staff.
Bolivia denies the allegations of harassment. The government says Mexico even asked Bolivia to beef up security after protests began. Karen Longarik is the Bolivian foreign minister.
Mire, yo me resisto a creer que el gobierno mexicano.
I'm reluctant to believe that the Mexican government would risk bringing a lawsuit before the International Court of Justice for facts that have not occurred. These are mere presumptions. This lawsuit will be rejected immediately.
The United States recognizes the new government of Bolivia, but so far U.S. officials have largely kept quiet about this diplomatic feud. Every year, Spain has a Christmas lottery called El Gordo, or the Fat One, and for good reason. The El Gordo jackpot is worth more than $2 billion. So when the winning number, 26590, was announced, the winners, of course, went bananas. Natalia Escudero is a journalist with Spain's public broadcaster, RTVE. She was covering the El Gordo lottery, but get this, she was also one of the winners. Talk about a sweet day at work. She's saying, I'm not going in tomorrow. Natalia no trabajo mañana. Natalia doesn't work tomorrow. So Natalia quit her job in dramatic fashion on live TV to the amazement of her colleagues back in the studio. But this was all a little premature. Natalia had merely bought a share of a lottery ticket, not the full ticket, meaning her winnings turned out to be not in the billions, not even the millions, but just $5,500. Natalia was right about one thing, though. On Twitter, apologizing for the confusion, she wrote, I maintain that tomorrow I will not work because I am going to celebrate and I am going on vacation. Yep, clearly she won't be deterred. The HBO series Chernobyl brought the story of the 1986 nuclear disaster in Ukraine to a new audience. It also won 3 Emmys. Lyudmila Ignatenko was a key character in the series. She was married to one of the first firefighters to die. Well, the real-life Lyudmila Ignatenko says she never gave HBO permission to tell her story. And now she says she's had to go into hiding because of media harassment. But Ignatenko agreed to speak with the BBC's Olga Malchevska in her first interview since the series aired.
For the viewing public, it's a window on the past. The worst nuclear disaster in living history, when reactor number 4 in Chernobyl in Ukraine blew up. But for Lyudmila Ignatenko, the series relives a horrific time in her life when she had to watch her firefighter husband die from radiation poisoning. After the HBO series aired, Lyudmila says the media attention and scrutiny was so intense that she had to leave Kyiv. For half a year, she has been in hiding in a remote village in the countryside. She has agreed to talk to us as long as we don't reveal her location.
Journalists were constantly pestering me. It was very stressful, and I feel offended that my story has been distorted.
What exactly did they distort?
That I had killed my baby. They were asking why I had been at my husband's bedside knowing that I was pregnant at the time. But tell me, how could I leave him? I thought my baby was safe inside me. We didn't know anything about radiation then.
Lyudmila's baby died 4 hours after being born. She says she never gave HBO permission to tell her story.
I think the film company behaved very badly by not meeting me, especially since they were filming in Kyiv. There was a phone call from Moscow. They said they were filming in Latvia and in Kyiv and wanted to contact me, but they couldn't. The movie was already filmed by then. They said, we'll pay you $3,000. I told them that nobody pays money for nothing and hung up.
HBO disputes this.
The production team, via local representatives, had multiple exchanges with Lyudmila Ignatenko. At no point during these exchanges did she express that she did not wish her story or that of her husband Vasily to be included. The filmmakers made every effort to depict their story and that of everyone affected by this tragedy with authenticity and respect.
It's a misunderstanding that has left Lyudmila feeling isolated. She has only caught snippets of the series when it was broadcast on Ukrainian television.
It was very hard to watch, and there were lies in the movie. Me standing with his shoes in my hands. Yes, they buried Vasily with his shoes off, but the shoes were beside him.
But the attention to detail in some parts moved her.
People were really so lightly dressed. I had a similar grey jumper.
I asked her about a moment in the film where Vasily had brought her flowers in the hospital.
Yes, it was 1st of May. I shall remember until the end of my life how we stood by the window together. We did not know that it would be our last moment together.
Some 33 years after the Chernobyl disaster, their wedding day photo still has pride of place in her home and her heart. She never remarried.
The BBC's Olga Malchevska there. Over in Russia, the Kremlin is busy sharpening its tools to silence opponents of President Vladimir Putin. It recently tested out Russia's countrywide alternative to the global internet. This week, police also raided the office of Moscow's most well-known opposition figure, Alexei Navalny, and his team. On top of that, one of Navalny's close allies was forcibly conscripted into the army. Nikita Kulinchenkov knows that man from Navalny's group, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Nikita joined us from Berlin.
They cannot take him forcefully to the army. It's just there is no such legal way to do that. So, and this is why this is so unusual, because it's just like something not within the law, and it's like so cynically taken to the place where there's no communication and there is no civil. As far as we know, there is no civil transport or civil service to this place. So journalists won't be able to get there. So lawyers won't be able to get there unless they got the seat in the military plane.
So this is a relatively new tactic by the Kremlin. What concerns you most about it?
Well, because it's actually a prison sentence for 1 year for the person, because he would be in the Arctic, he won't be able to leave, and at the same time he has the military oath, he has the medical conditions preventing him from serving in the army, and so it's something like extraordinary, and it's something like like arrest or detention.
Nikita, help us understand, what exactly is the goal of FBK, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, Navalny's organization? What is the work you do?
We are making investigations, we publish them, and we inform the general Russian public on what is actually happening and how the corruption works in the highest level of the Russian government. This is just the basic idea. At the same time, since Alexei Navalny is a politician and his like main platform is the fighting of the corruption, we support his main political platform.
And as I said earlier, you're in Berlin, Nikita. You're actually wanted in Russia by the FSB, the Domestic Security Forces. Why are you willing to take these risks, continuing to do this work on behalf of Putin's opposition?
It was almost like 7 or 6 years ago when I at one point thought that I'm not going to be anymore in the corporate environment and I'm going to do something for my country. And I chose to work for Alexei.
So I was watching Alexei Navalny crack jokes with his colleagues and make light of the raid while it was happening. I'm sure you haven't lost your sense of Russian humor, but I mean, how are you able to do that? And in Berlin, do you still see the humor in all this?
Well, if you are in Berlin, it's easier to see jokes in that because you don't have that risk that your computer will be stolen by the police officers. You get used to it. I think half of our employees were at least interrogated or detained once, and some of them spent several months in total in these short detentions.
Still, nothing funny about detention. So what we're looking at here at the end of 2019 is the Kremlin staging a number of schemes to silence the opposition in Russia. What's next for FBK, the Anti-Corruption Foundation? Or are you looking more at 2021 when there are parliamentary elections in Russia?
So we have implemented this smart vote tactic or smart vote system in this year in summer, and it was successful. We say here are the candidates that are not anyhow linked to the United Russia, the pro-government party. So we expect that we're going to use the same tactic and this smart vote system in 2021 in the State Duma elections. However, it depends on the activities and the steps of the government, because we believe that they are trying to implement these new restrictions in internet or attempting to implement them because they would like to block some particular content or some particular videos in YouTube, for example, or some particular website like the Smart Vote. But let's see what they will do. So our tactic may change.
Nikita Kulichenkov in Berlin. He works on the investigations unit at the Anti-Corruption Foundation, a group led by prominent opposition leader in Moscow, Alexei Navalny. Nikita, thank you very much.
Marco, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman. I'm going to take you on a music journey through some trends of the last decade, starting with this.
Open Gangnam Style.
And ending with this.
So here comes the African giant.
Music trends of the 2010s that's still ahead here on The World. Many of us had time off this week celebrating the holidays or spending a few cozy days curled up at home with family. Not everyone, though. A team of nearly a dozen scientists was about as far from home as they could get this week on a windswept glacier at the edge of West Antarctica, where it sounds something like this. Kaya Riverman is one of the scientists who's there now. We spoke with her earlier this month before she headed south from her post at the University of Oregon.
Truth be told, weather is, I think, the biggest concern. It's been a rough year for weather in Antarctica.
So far, though, the weather has cooperated. Riverman and her team had a window of clear skies to fly to their remote field camp on Thwaites Glacier early this week. They hope to start answering some key questions about the floating edge of the glacier and the warm ocean currents thought to be melting it from below.
How deep is the water? How thick is the ice? Where are these warm ocean currents?
Thwaites is a glacier the size of Florida, and it's melting fast. That could someday trigger the collapse of the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, and that would push global sea levels up about 11 feet. Riverman was part of a small advance team on the ice last year that identified a safe patch of the glacier to work on.
The big new piece of what we're doing this year is we'll be drilling through the ice and actually putting instruments down to measure the properties of the ocean below. And so figuring out where we can safely drill and then going about the drilling and putting the instruments down will be a fun challenge.
What they use to drill through the ice, it's a little surprising.
So we use hot water, actually, to drill through the ice. So we send jets of hot water and melt a small hole in the ice. And then we put instruments through, like one called the ice fin. It's this underwater vehicle that's on a tether up to the surface, and it will be swimming around under the ice to map properties of the water.
Riverman's team will also dangle sensors through the drill holes and leave them there all year. Those will collect data throughout the winter in the Southern Hemisphere. The world's Carolyn Beeler sent audio recording gear along with that first advance team that went down to Thwaites last winter. She gave the gear to lead scientist Sridhar Anandakrishnan, who recorded sound and audio diaries. Using that material, Carolyn produced this story earlier this year. Let's listen.
So Sridhar Anandakrishnan and his team's journey started at this tiny field camp in the middle of Antarctica. They waited there for about a week for weather that was good enough to fly out to Thwaites Glacier.
All right, it's Tuesday, January, what, 8th? Looks like they've given us the go-ahead to fly this morning. All right, Kaya, so what's the plan this morning?
All right, so we're going to get on the plane, fly. So my name is Kaya Riverman, and I am a postdoc at the University of Oregon.
The science team, Sridhar and Kaya, is with two mountaineers whose main job is to make sure they don't fall into crevasses on Thwaites. Seriously. They're Mike Roberts, who's from New Zealand.
So they could just do it as an overflight.
And Andy Bond, an American.
I think we're good. We just did our last checkoff.
Okay. Let's do this. We're on the airplane now.
Well, that kind of works.
What is that?
This is a safety guide.
You're using the safety guide to scrape
the
windows?
No, but it's for the New Zealand Antarctic program. It's not
okay.
For the U.S.
In that case, it must not apply.
In a minute here, the pilots are going to go through their checklist, and then we'll head out of here. It's about a two-hour flight.
They fly off from the base camp 300 miles toward the edge of West Antarctica. That's where the continent's ice sheets are being melted by a warming sea. Sridhar will tell most of the story. I'll jump in from time to time. He starts when the plane dropped his team off at Thwaites. They landed on a piece of ice the size of Florida. That's one of the most isolated places on Earth.
There you are, standing on a chunk of flat ice. The airplane is going away, and you're waving bye-bye to it. And it's a scary feeling, but a very exhilarating feeling at the same time.
Testing, testing. I think we're going okay. 18, 19, okay. Okay, so we're on the Thwaites Glacier ice shelf.
We landed!
You realize I am completely alone. There's only the four of us here, and there's nobody else around. And particularly on Thwaites Glacier, the nearest people were 300 miles away, and that was 20 of them. And that is a truly terrifying idea if you think about it too much, and so you don't think about it a whole lot. Okay, it's our second day here on the Thwaites Glacier ice shelf. It's about 10 o'clock at night. There is just blue sky all the way around. No wind. It's quite cold, about 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're at our camp. I see my cook tent, and then we have our sleeping tents. It's perfectly flat where we are, but there's a magnificent ridge just to the south of us. That's what we call the grounding line of Thwaites, which is a pretty remarkable spot to be at.
The spot that Sridhar's standing there looking at is sort of the key to the glacier's future. It's where the glacier stops being grounded, literally sitting on the ground, the bedrock under Antarctica, and extends out into the sea.
It rises about 300 feet over the course of about 2 or 3 miles.
So not the ice rises up there because there's a ridge in the seafloor right underneath it. That ridge is acting like a break on the glacier. It's holding the ice back from flowing out faster and faster into the sea. When I talked to Sridhar about it after he got back, he spoke about this spot's importance in really stark terms.
What we were looking at was Thwaites Glacier's blast defense against warming. So the glacier is stable as long as the grounding line stays on that ridge. If it were to step back from that ridge, then it would contribute enormously to sea level. And boy, oh boy, as a glaciologist, you talk about the grounding line, you model it, and I had never in my life expected to see it right there, just visible to us.
I could stand here for a long, long time, but I think I'm probably gonna end this and go to bed. About the only sound is the crunch of your footsteps around here.
Warm ocean water under the ice that Sridhar is walking over is flowing toward the grounding line that he just saw and melting the glacier. This glacier that could flood coastal cities around the world. And Sridhar's team is here to help figure out how fast that might happen. Next year, they'll be sinking underwater probes through the ice sheet. This year, they're doing seismic testing with small explosions to find the best places to do that.
Hi, it's Monday, 14th of January. We're on Thwaites grounding zone.
We lay out geophones on the surface of the snow, set off an explosive. The sound energy from that explosive shot goes down through the ice, through the water column, comes back to us, and is recorded by the geophones. That process tells us how thick the ice column is, how thick the water column is.
And that is the sound of Kaya working while I stand here holding the microphone.
Well, I'm digging a hole maybe 3 feet deep.
I wouldn't say 3 feet.
No, but see, it is down there.
And Kaya and I went out there first thing to slant the geophones.
And then we do that 47 more times.
And the next day, Andy and I went off to a second location.
So yesterday we loaded all the holes with high explosive.
Quick time check, 21:36:26.
And now we're going to detonate. Okay, he's arming the high voltage. 10 seconds to go.
So drilling 10 feet into a glacier that's on the verge of collapse and sticking explosives into it and detonating them, does this hurt the glacier?
That's a very good question. So the glacier itself is about 2,000 feet thick at that spot.
Glaciologist Sridhar Anandakrishnan says drilling small holes, even packing them with explosives, doesn't weaken the glacier or contribute to its collapse.
Less than a pinprick for Thwaites Glacier.
I'll shut down and wrap up here and then come help you guys shovel. Good morning. It's Thursday the 17th, about 6 a.m. I'm going to wake up in a minute. Get out of my sleeping bag. It's always the hardest part of the day.
So when we were out there working, we would work from breakfast.
All right, time to motivate. Here we go.
Really, as long as we thought it was safe and viable to do.
Two fingers of Wino.
And then we'd come back in the evening and then start cooking dinner.
Oh, it is a nice view. I like that sort of reddish tint on the horizon. With the boosters and detonators in the foreground.
Nothing like some casual explosives on the horizon to make your...
So Sridhar, Kaya Riverman, and the two mountaineers worked for about a week on West Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier. Sridhar kept recording audio through a lot of it. They finished all their seismic testing and were all set to fly out the next day.
So it's Thursday, January 17th. We're still at grounding zone. The weather forecasters got it right. They said we're getting a storm, and the winds picked up overnight.
So you hear this big storm is coming.
We'd hoped to get out this morning, but the flight was canceled.
You prep camp, and then it's time to hunker down.
So when the winds are blowing as hard as they are, 30, 40, 50 miles per hour, ordinary things become incredibly difficult. Just walking from one tent to another tent.
It's kind of like that mental image of someone opening up a furnace and the, like,
fiery blast and sparks blowing out at them, except in our case it's the fiery, icy blast of snow and wind.
You almost can't see the other tent.
You can't stand up straight. You can't walk straight. I had a moment of worrying that it was just going to pull me off into the abyss.
The next thing that's problematic is when you have to take a whiz, as it were. What's the proper word here that I can use on PRI?
I have yet to master the art of peeing into a Nalgene.
And this is particularly hard for women.
It's a harrowing experience a little bit, because you have to pull down your pants in this, which inevitably fills them with snow, so then you pull them back up and you've just got snow all down your pants.
Finally, you've done all these things. You've taken a pee, you've walked hand in hand from tent one to tent
okay,
two.
Okay, you're clear.
Thank you.
Now you have to open up the sleeping tent and crawl into it. And it has this round tunnel-like entrance.
And now she is crawling in through the tunnel, which with the wind howling as it is, brings a great deal of snow along with it. That's quite all right.
Once you've crawled into the tent, now you're safe. It's cold, 10, 15 degrees Fahrenheit, but you have sleeping bags. And we knew that we would be spending many, many hours in there.
We're not quite sure when this will die down, obviously. It's just this freight train sound.
We crawled into our tents about 10 or 11 in the morning, and then we were there until the following day, until about 8 or 10 in the morning. I've been to the Antarctic more than 20 times, and this really was the worst storm I've been in.
Well, quite a difference 12 hours can make. The winds have dropped considerably. We spent the day in the endurance tent, chatting, watching a movie.
Two movies.
Had a nice dinner, and we're getting ready for bed. If the weather continues to moderate, and the weather's good at the fueling site, then we might have an airplane tomorrow. But that's a lot of ifs. Anyways, that's all for now.
A plane did come the next day. With all the waiting and weather delays, the trip to Thwaites Glacier took almost a month, for just a week of actual research. When he was back home, lead scientist Sridhar Anandakrishnan told me that just shows how difficult it is to learn anything about the natural world and how it's changing.
Every piece of knowledge is hard fought, and we have to make the best of it, and hopefully people will find value in what we've learned.
And what is your hope for this data that you fight so hard for?
This particular project is to try and understand and project what Thwaites Glacier is going to contribute to sea level over the next century.
Sridhar's work is part of a 5-year international quest to answer that question. Already, his team has found something that doesn't bode well for the future of the glacier. They found the underwater cavity, at least in the spot they were working in, is really big. That means there's plenty of room for warm water to circulate underneath the glacier and melt it from below. But Sridhar hopes this work does more than just describe what's going on in this remote corner of Earth.
More broadly, if we can make some definitive statements about what Thwaites Glacier is going to do to sea level over the next century, we can make an alternate statement saying if we reduce our carbon emissions by this amount, well, maybe its contribution to sea level will be reduced. So ultimately, what I'd like to be able to say is out of this process, we have a couple of alternate future timelines.
Which of those alternate futures we choose is then up to us.
The World's Carolyn Beeler reporting on an expedition to Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. She also sent more audio gear down to the scientists earlier this month, so we'll be hearing more from Thwaites Glacier in 2020. Now that we're in the final days of the decade, the teens of the 21st century, we've been giving some thought to the musical trends that really stood out over the past 10 years. A lot has changed. You can find some of the trends we spotted at theworld.org, but let's run through a few of them right now. As the decade began, who'd have thunk that Korean boy bands would conquer the globe? There was a big clue back in 2012. His name was Psy.
Open Gangnam Style.
Yeah, a surreal video by a cute Korean chap who went to school right here in Boston. The video is unforgettable. Psy dancing in a stable, pretending to ride a horse through a chorus line of girls, having some fun with the lively upscale neighborhood in Seoul, Gangnam, that most fans outside Korea had never heard of. 4 years later, the boy band BTS sells out Madison Square Garden several times. Sadly, the decade is closing with several deaths among the top acts in K-pop. But the star maker machinery of Seoul seems to keep marching on. Another seismic shift this past decade, how we listen to music. Across the planet, actually owning music gave way toward downloads, streaming. Essentially, we're tapping into ginormous digital jukeboxes in the cloud, Spotify, Apple Music, and so on. In some parts of the world, street merchants sell SIM cards and thumb drives already loaded with music. But the big change was in the actual physical product, as they say in the biz, a retro swing back to vinyl. This one's an old Celia Cruz 45. In fact, this year, vinyl sales topped CD sales for the first time in 30 years in the U.S. Ayana Contreras is a vinyl devotee. She's a music producer and DJ at WBEZ in Chicago. And for her, the vinyl trend makes perfect sense.
The number one thing that I think has changed for folks is we have the luxury to be able to choose our medium in a way that cherishes the experiential aspect of it. Basically, picking up a record, pulling it out of the sleeve, putting it on the turntable, being very intentional is something that holds a lot of romance for younger kids. And for older people, you know, it's very nostalgic. It's that sweet spot between a number of different generations sort of really being attracted to not simply pressing a button in order to hear any song on demand.
The crackles and pops, that's just for effect. Vinyl sounds better than ever. Angelique Kidjo released Celia, her best-selling homage to Celia Cruz, on CD and vinyl, which brings us to another trend, the old genre of world music, kind of obsolete at this point. The internet and file sharing mean that artists everywhere no longer toil away in the vacuum of regional culture. Everything around the globe inspires now. Look specifically at the African continent over the past 10 years, long the source of many sounds simply called world music. That all-encompassing label gave way to a distinct 21st century genre of pop music. In fact, there's a new sales chart on the continent that didn't exist in 2010, Charts Africa. Their top 10 albums for 2019, Angelique Kidjo Celia is on it, but with only one other exception, everything else is millennial music. Tell them Africa, we don't die, yeah. At number one on Charts Africa's top albums this year is African Giant by arguably Nigeria's biggest star of the moment, Burna Boy. It's a slow jam with heavy autotune, definitely not Afropop, even though it is pop from Africa. You could say that the internet democratized music by helping to eliminate the ghetto of world music. But just because pop music globally appears to be on a more even playing field, it's also not fully employed its bully pulpit. There have been artists like Seyun Kuti who warned his fellow Nigerians to not get sucked into a consumer lifestyle in songs like African Dreams. Too many yummy youths, lost to television, chasing the American dream. Tell me who they dream for Africa. Too many or New Zealand's youth. Lord and her tune Royals calling out over the top bling. But everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash, we don't care.
We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal. For Lord, it was Royals. Every song's like Gold Teeth, Grey Goose, Tripping in the Bathroom, Bloodstains, Ball Gowns, Trashing the Hotel Room.
That's writer Alyssa Quart, who heads up the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. After the 2008 Great Recession, musicians had a chance to critique socioeconomic inequality around the world, but Alyssa Quart says artists mostly came up short.
What does it mean when you don't have music or visual art or other forms that don't, in the last decade, speak to this?
And I think then you start to lose the cultural claim on being a democratic art. People call out each other, check your privilege, but the cultural production is not checking its privilege.
It's a trend that critic and writer Scott Timberg wrote about last year, an essay in Vox titled How Music Has Responded to a Decade of Economic Inequality. Scott died unexpectedly this past month.
Well, Scott Timberg was my friend and my colleague, and I edited this piece of his about inequality in music. And I think he did really worry about what was going to happen with cultural production, but he was always an optimist. Like, even in his last week, he was posting, you know, Kurt Vile, who's a younger indie musician, a collaboration he did, a video from that. And it was really beautiful. And I think that he still kept his mind and ear connected to better work that was being made.
And speaking of better work, we lost great artists in the 2010s, so many that it felt like a trend. Aretha, Bowie, Prince, artists with seemingly limitless talent who stayed true to innovation and boldness, legacies that show us great art requires hard work. We'll go out with one reminder of what one of them left behind. I heard Brazilian singer Seu Jorge sing this David Bowie classic the day after the 2016 election, Changes. I guess in many respects it neatly sums up the past decade of music in many areas. And on that note, I wish you a happy new year. I'm taking a few days off next week. Carol Hills will be in the host chair, and I'll be back with you in 2020. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You have yourselves a great weekend. We're back on the air Monday.
É só o jeito que eu sou. Changes lá. Vem meu trem. Tô saindo fora porque vou me dar bem. Changes lá. Vem meu trem. Sei que tá na hora que eu vou me dar bem. Sempre em frente. Assim permitir, só procurar fazer amigos do bem. Se precisar ajudar também. E agora liberdade e horizonte. Só você não sacou. Nova York, Ipanema, Hong Kong. É nessa aí que eu tô. Changes lá, vem meu trem, tô saindo fora porque eu sei que vou me dar bem. Changes lá, vem meu trem, sei que tá na hora e eu vou me dar bem, sempre em frente. Changes lá, vem meu trem, tô saindo fora e eu sei que vou me dar bem. Changes lá, vem meu trem, tô saindo fora e eu sei que vou me dar bem. Sempre em frente, nunca pra trás, sempre em frente, nunca pra trás.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.